Next up, where did we come from and what does it mean to be human? These are some of the big questions that scientists have been trying to answer for centuries, but they are also the same ideas that have inspired some of the greatest artists. And I'm going to be introducing a couple of my guests to talk about that now. John Gerchy is a paleo artist and author of Shaping Humanity, How Science, Art, and Imagination Help Us Understand Our Origins. He's from Ithaca, New York, and he joins us from Cornell University studios there. Welcome to Science Friday.
Oh, thank you, Ira. Good to be here.
Thank you. Rick Potts is a paleoanthropologist and director of the Human Origins Program at the National Museum of Natural History. That's at the Smithsonian in Washington. Welcome, Rick, to Science Friday.
Thanks very much, Ira. Great to be here.
Now, John, you actually studied science and not art. How did you get into this?
Well, I think the simplest way to answer that is just to say when you're a kid and you're interested in something, and I mean a little kid, you do art about it. And so if you're interested in science, some aspect of science, you draw pictures of it or make little clay sculptures. And I think the shortest way to explain this and easiest is just to say that I never quit. And so in school, I realized early on that it would be much harder to go to art school and try to keep up with the scientific literature on the side than it would be doing the reverse of that. That is, taking paleontology and anthropology and keeping the art alive on the side. So I did the latter.
So how is sculpting for a museum different from other kind of art?
Well, this has to be, you really have to change heads about every 5 seconds when you're doing this kind of work, because you have to be aware of both the artistic side and the aesthetic side, and also the scientific constraints you're operating under. The more you know about it, scientifically, that is, the more constrained you are. So if you are a person who's done a lot of anatomical research, a lot of dissection and that kind of thing, and if you have a lot of information about this species that's been put forth by various anthropologists studying the fossils, then you're more constrained than you would otherwise be, and you can't just make a fantasy, you know?
Yeah.
So you're not as free, but you do have to keep the aesthetic side alive. Otherwise, you just have a sort of a dead anatomical model at the end.
I'm Ira Flatow. Let me just give a little break. We'll come back. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. Okay, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to be so rudely interrupted.
Sure, that's fine.
I was looking at through the book, this gorgeous, gorgeous book, Shaping Humanity.
Oh, thanks.
And what shocked me most is how precise you mimic the human body. You know, we don't see any of the thing underneath the skin or the top part, which looks like you could be working at the Madame Tussauds. It's so beautifully finished. But that is all necessary to get that right. All the details underneath.
Yeah, I think so.
All the muscles and the fibers and the tendons and everything else are there, but we never see them.
Yeah, I think they have a cumulative effect on the final form that's important. So I can't just go in there and start with what looks like an arm to me, you know. I have to build it. And usually the bones have something to say about how that particular species is developed in terms of musculature and so forth. So you're wanting to pay attention as you sculpt to what the bones are telling you. Maybe there are strong muscle markings on the bones for flexor muscles of the hand and arm,
right,
that sort of thing. So you want to give it strong musculature there.
You got it all in there.
Yep.
Rick Potts is a scientist. When you see the results, when you see John's work, and he's basically reconstructing stuff from fossils and bones, does it help confirm in your head things that you suspected or give you a real view of what these folks might have looked like back then?
Well, first of all, I see John's artwork as absolutely beautiful. And everything that John does in his art reflects an idea, in some sense, a scientific hypothesis about what they look like, about what kinds of activities they were doing, even things about the rigors of life, the dangers that they faced. And John and I think together a lot about these things. And so, yes, to a certain extent, it confirms what we think. But at the same time, the final product can be entirely surprising, and it's just extraordinary to see the visitors to the Smithsonian's Natural History Museum come into the hall and be sometimes shocked and moved to tears, I've even seen, in some of the interactions that people have with John's artwork.
Mm-hmm. You had an example of how John's figures helped you scrutinize the bridge of the nose of Homo erectus. Tell us about that.
Yeah, right. Well, Homo erectus, which the first fossils we have of this species, this ancestor of ours, go back to almost 2 million years in Africa. And in the first few fossils that we find of it that far back, we can see in the skulls that there is a bridging of the nasal bones. You know, if you put your finger right between your eyes and go down a little bit, we all have a bridge of the nose. That's a characteristic of our species. And Homo erectus was the first to have that. And in talking with John and with other scientists who were working on this at that time, when John was doing the sculptures and getting the ideas for them, it was discovered that the expansion of that nasal area, that middle part of the face, was really important when environments were very dry. In a sense, what's going on there is that as air is breathed out, that it eddies, it forms little eddies in all those little nooks and crannies inside that expanded nasal cavity, and the water drops out. You don't breathe out the water, you're actually conserving it. And this is, of course, a very important adaptation in some of the dry conditions in which those ancestors lived.
I see. So that explains it by the reconstruction. We're going to take a break and come back and talk more with John Gerchy and Rick Potts. If you'd like to ask about, this is a great book. John's book is Shaping Humanity, How Science, Art, and the Imagination Help Us Understand Our Origins. Our number, 844-724-8255, 844-SCI-TALK. So stay with us. We'll be right back after the break. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking this hour about art and science and about reconstructing hominids from long time ago. Our guests are John Gerchy, paleo artist and author of Shaping Humanity, How Science, Art, and Imagination Help Us Understand Our Origins. He joins us from Cornell University. Rick Potts is a paleoanthropologist and director of the Human Origins Program at the National Museum of Natural History at the Smithsonian Institution in Washington, D.C. And John, you make wonderful exhibits for Rick.
Thank you.
They're terrific and featured in the book. What technique do you use? Tell us what your figures are constructed out of that make them so lifelike. And did you have to experiment a lot to get to where you are?
Oh, I did. And there were blind alleys, or rather paths that turned out not to be very successful. But when I first started doing this kind of thing, I wanted to make them as lifelike as possible. And I hadn't seen anything out there that sort of matched that standard, except for maybe some things in the movies. So I turned to some movie people and asked them a lot of questions and sort of cobbled together a method from that. I talked to, for example, Dick Smith used to be in the special effects makeup industry. He was working on old age makeup for David Bowie for the movie The Hunger in those days. But when he was very helpful, and there were a number of other special effects people that helped me. So I had a fork in the road at one point, and that was to go in the direction of using silicone or in the direction of using urethane. Well, for a number of practical reasons, I chose urethane, and that turned out to be the wrong path. Not only is that stuff nasty to work with health-wise, but it also, if it's soft enough to punch hair into, which mine had to be,
right.
Then it eventually, the material begins to attack itself, and some figures actually melted that were made in those days.
Kidding.
So I am now a firm believer in silicone, and that's a really great material to use because you can tint it any color, you can control the luster and the amount of translucence, so you can control pretty much everything. And it's also soft enough to punch hair into, so it's pretty much the perfect material, I think.
How do you guys know, both you, John and Rick? How do you know how the posture to put the figures in? Because that could be one of the great unknowns of how they walked.
Well, or is it?
Or I is mean, it?
Okay. Rick, you can correct me on this, but the bones have a lot to say. The bones have a lot to say about how they moved and how they stood and so forth. And there are some arguments, but for example, almost everybody agrees that a hominid like Lucy, the famous Lucy, 3.2 million year old Australopithecus fossil, was walking on two legs. Hardly anybody would dispute that. So there are some clear signals the bones can give you. And let me just turn it over to you, Rick, if you want to add to that.
Sure, yeah. Well, from the details of the fossil bones, you can see the muscle markings on the bones. You can actually measure the thickness of the bone itself. And all of those little hints are clues as to the rigors of life, how forceful the muscles were pulling on the bones, how much the individual may have even been walking with long distance, with endurance in terms of how well built the leg bones are. And so what we try to do in the back and forth between the science and the art here was to try to capture that as best as possible, have postures that were scientifically well-grounded, and then from there we moved on to the matter of, well, what do we have these early humans doing? It's one thing to talk about the forensics, the anatomy, but another thing to actually put them into motion, into action.
And how do you decide what you have them doing?
Well, one of the things is that, for example, one of my favorite statues in the bronze statues in the exhibition, a statue that John did, was of the species known as Homo heidelbergensis, based on a fossil originally that was found in Heidelberg, Germany. And it's the common ancestor of Neanderthals, the famed Neanderthals, and our species, Homo sapiens. And it's thought to be the first to have controlled fire and to build shelters. And so one of the things that we did is, and John really, I think, first came up with this idea, is that we would have a bronze fireplace with the individual Homo heidelbergensis crouched behind it and handing food across the coals of the fire. And we had a little bronze bench that's across from it. And why it's my favorite art piece in the exhibit is because the visitor has to sit down across from the Homo heidelbergensis in order to complete the artwork, basically to take this offer of shared food.
So the visitor becomes part of the piece.
The visitor becomes part of the piece, and that's a really beautiful moment.
That is great.
Yeah, it really is.
And John, you built that into knowing that would be part of it?
Oh, definitely, definitely. Yeah. We at one point I realized each of these sculptures represents a social species. And so a social species is basically engaged perpetually in a dance. And I thought, why shouldn't the dance be between the sculpture and not another sculpture, but actually the museum visitor? So that was kind of the beginning of this. And then we started thinking about ways that we could express that. And and as it turns out, Rick mentioned that we were trying to In coming up with poses for these sculptures, we were trying to reflect something of their story. And it turns out that the story of each human ancestor is different. It's unique among the lineup of ancestors and different from the ones that came before and after. And that's because human evolution turns out not to be a process where all of the things we think of as humans slowly evolve in tandem together. It's more of a mosaic process where some things happen early, some things happen really late. And so each ancestor in the lineup will have a different part of the human picture that it's adding to the puzzle.
So is this exhibit permanently, Rick, at the Smithsonian?
It sure is, yes. It's a permanent exhibition hall at the National Museum of Natural History in Washington. And it's been, I think we just celebrated our fourth year anniversary, and there's something on the order of about 20 to 22 million people who have already come into it. And so that's it's getting a great reach and have a great website where people can look up further information and explore deeper into the science.
Well, if they can't get in to take a look, seeing John Gerge's book, Shaping Humanity, How Science, Art, and Imagination Help Us Understand Our Origins, is sloppy second. So, but it's a great book and beautifully done. So congratulations, John. I highly recommend it. It's a great coffee table and gift, whatever. It's a beautiful book, and I learned a lot you're just leafing through it. Thanks for taking time to be with us today.
Sure. It's great to be here.
Sure, Rick, thing, Ira. Rick, good to be with you.
Rick Potts, paleoanthropologist and director of the Human Origins Program at the National Museum of Natural History at the Smithsonian in Washington.